So as you can see from the announcement, the rally that is scheduled for Thursday means that most buildings on Bascom Hill will be closed all day Thursday. Bascom Hall is actually open, and technically, I was told it might be possible to hold the class, except everybody would have to go through metal detectors and security before getting in here. So you'd have to line up, you know, a long time ahead of time. And it just seemed, I was advised that basically any class that's on top of the hill should be canceled. So that's what we'll do. Now, unfortunately, because of the finely tuned character of all the topics in the course, there's a problem that I have to drop a session because, you know, there's no realistic way of rescheduling a class. I think what we'll do then is the following. Next Tuesday, we will have the lecture scheduled for Tuesday. So the lecture that was scheduled for this coming Thursday, which is the lecture on finance, we will postpone. We'll still have the midterm next Thursday, rather than postpone the midterm. But finance and the readings on finance will not be covered in the first midterm. Okay, so just the chapters in the book for Thursday. Next Thursday, I'm out of town, and so the TAs will be here to take care of the exam, and that's why we couldn't just push the exam forward. In any case, I think it's time to have the first exam in the class. What I'll probably do is, in the course of the next block of courses, there are a couple of sessions which are scheduled as two lecture blocks, the session on gender and the session on race. This is in the middle part of the course dealing with inequality. Both of those sessions are scheduled to take up two lectures. I'm going to go through the material and see if I can have those two topics span three lectures, which will then open up the space for the finance lecture, which I really want to give. I've been working on it, and it's interesting, and it's obviously important to have at least a basic understanding of the peculiar ways that finance is organized in general in capitalist markets, but in particular in the American context, and how that helps to explain some of the difficulties we're facing economically at the present, and also what this means for our institutions. Remember, we're not mainly interested in economics per se, we're interested in how it affects institutions. So that's how we'll accommodate this. So just to repeat, no class Thursday, next Tuesday the class as scheduled, and the topic as scheduled, and the exam will therefore not cover finance. You don't have to worry about it for this midterm. Well, today's topic is healthcare and the market. The production and distribution of medical services is really a complex social phenomenon. And it's impossible, obviously, in a single lecture to give you a full-blown account of either healthcare as a general problem that societies have to deal with or the particular institutions that we have to deal with it. What I want to emphasize, at least at the beginning of the lecture, are things about healthcare which make it very different from any other kind of market. What is distinctive about the delivery of services around healthcare that makes it really distinctive and poses special problems? Why is it not like a grocery store or an electronics store that's selling your computers? Let's see, there we go. What are the distinctive features of healthcare as a commodity? The word commodity means something that's produced for a market. What's distinctive about this? So before I give you my answers to the question, I think in my list I'm going to give you six really distinctive things about healthcare. I want to ask you the question, what do you think? What are some distinctive things? What makes healthcare not like buying your groceries? Yeah.
It affects your
So what you're buying will change your life. It affects your well-being. Well, of course, lots of products affect your well-being. And indeed, food, of course, does. But you are tapping in. You're capturing something. Yeah.
It's the difference between life and death.
Okay, so it's whoops. Oh, here's a jog. So life and death, well-being. Yeah, so it seems to, but these are tapped, there's something really intensely valuable about it. It's not just one among many things that you might value. It's really intensely valuable. And sometimes of, you know, absolutely, as you said, life and death value. Other things distinctive. Yeah.
If you choose not to buy it, it can affect other people.
That's an interesting idea, that your decision whether or not you're going to buy health care affects other people. So it has externalities. What would be some examples of externalities on other people from your purchase or consumption of health care? Anybody? I mean, you can answer that too, but what did you have in mind as an example?
Like, if people don't buy it and they don't use the healthcare system, then more of the costs are pushed onto the people that do use it. But, like, if you don't, I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this, but, like, if you don't use it, you're not using it at the time, but it's there if you need it.
So there you're really saying if you don't buy insurance,
yeah,
and then you end up using it anyway, and you can't pay for it, somebody has to pay for it, so you're therefore displacing costs onto other people,
yeah,
if you don't buy insurance. So that's a specific thing about insurance. But there are other examples. If you don't consume health care, it could affect other people. Yeah.
If you contract an illness and you don't have medical care and you can't buy medicine, then you have a greater chance of affecting others around you.
Yeah, so that's a point. And that's not just about insurance. If you have an aversion to doctors, you know, you just don't like to go to the doctor, and you catch a infectious disease and you don't get treated, then you can infect other people. There's another instance about infecting other people if you don't use the healthcare system that is actually a big problem. Does anybody? Yeah.
Vaccines,
right. So some people are opposed to vaccination. Some vaccines have this interesting quality. If 99% of the population is vaccinated, then it doesn't matter whether you're vaccinated, because you won't catch the disease because it won't spread in a population. But if only, for some diseases, if only 70% of the population get vaccinated, that 30% is a big enough population for an infectious disease to take hold and therefore generate an epidemic. So in a way, the refusal to get a vaccine is an example of what general theoretical idea that we've talked about. What's the, yeah?
Free riding.
Free riding. You want other people to get vaccinated because you don't want to get sick, but you don't want to get vaccinated. That was, historically, there were points where that was a very big issue around polio vaccines and smallpox vaccines, really serious illnesses. And there were people who opposed being vaccinated. Some countries said, too bad, everybody has to get vaccinated. The United States has had a more open policy, less coercive about this. But the United States, as I'll mention later in the lecture, or at least it's mentioned in the book, the US is one of the only places that doesn't provide free vaccinations to everyone. Because it's a public health issue, every other developed country simply doesn't charge anybody for vaccinations. It's free. Whereas here, you have to pay for it. Okay, other special things about healthcare. Yeah?
It's a different product for every person.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a nice point. It's not on my list. Add it to your list. It's highly tailored to each person's needs. No, it's not one size fits all. Different people have very different healthcare needs, which means that the services that deliver it have to be very attentive to your peculiar and particular situation. You can't just provide it in a kind of homogeneous way, because every person has very specific different needs. Other things, any other ideas, special properties of healthcare which make it difficult, different kind of, somebody from the back. You don't get off the hook just because you're sitting in the back. Somebody from the back must have an idea. Otherwise, this is proof of the point that people who sit in the back don't have ideas, which, of course, I don't believe. No, really? There's nobody in the back who has any thought about another point that you're in the front. You have to move to the... All right, one last thing.
If you
buy it, you don't want to have to use it. Well, that's true for buying insurance. If you buy healthcare itself, it's because you do want to use it. If you actually buy the healthcare service. When you buy insurance, your hope is that you don't need it. That's a very peculiar thing. If you buy home insurance, fire insurance, your hope is that your house doesn't burn down. When you buy automobile insurance, your hope is you don't have an accident. In some places, this creates a real kind of tense situation. There are places where, for example, flood insurance or hurricane insurance, if you're on the coast of Louisiana, it's pretty expensive now. If you don't buy it and there's a hurricane, you're devastated. If you do buy it, you hope you don't need it. That's a very weird kind of product to be buying. That's not special just for health insurance. That's for all insurance. For all insurance, you buy it and you don't want it, and you don't want to use it. All right, let me give you my special thing. Some of these we've talked about. The first is the extraordinary value of the service. The second thing are ethical issues in its distribution, which are stronger than ethical issues in the distribution of televisions. Almost everyone believes that people should not be denied basic medical care because they're poor. Now, not everybody believes that. Some people believe if you're poor, too bad. You can't afford something, that's your problem. Most people feel, however, that if you're poor, you shouldn't be denied basic health care. And I think probably, you know, just absolutely virtually everyone except some really grumpy person would believe that this is should be true for children. That is, in a rich country, a child born in a poor family should not, by virtue of that, be denied access to medical care. But I think most people believe it for adults as well. Health goes along with food and warmth as consumption goods that are as close as possible to being a human right. Indeed, there are many places in the world where it is included as a human right. You have a basic human right to food, shelter being the expression for warmth and the like, and milk care. So the question is not whether the poor should have access to it, but how they should get access. Should it be through charity? Charity by doctors? Charity by the public? Should the government provide it? Should the government provide insurance? That is, we could have hospitals just for the poor, or the government could just provide insurance and the poor could therefore get access to regular medical care. So that means, I think, that there are ethical issues bound up with health care that just don't kick in for most other commodities. Some politicians scoff at the idea that health care should be an entitlement. There was a recent speech by a well-known politician running for an important office who scoffed at the idea that, you know, people thought they were entitled to food, shelter, and health care. Whereas to me it just seems obvious that people are indeed entitled to. Now, that doesn't answer the question how much, what quality, under what conditions, but nevertheless, I think human beings are entitled to food, shelter, and health care. And then we have to worry about how do we accomplish that, not whether they're actually entitled to it. The fact that there are these ethical issues means, and this is a really hard issue, even a painful issue, healthcare has to be rationed one way or another. There's just no possible way that everybody can have the maximum amount of the highest quality health care that they might want. There has to be some mechanism of rationing. And ability to pay is one way of doing it. That's one way you can ration it. You can say poor people don't get it. But some kind of rationing is needed, and that means that you have to invoke ethical criteria. You have to figure out what are the moral issues involved and how should we properly do this difficult task of rationing. It's interesting in the United States because there are some kinds of medical rationing which we absolutely have on strong moral grounds. The official policies are to prevent it being rationed on the basis of ability to pay. Organ transplants, for example. If you need a heart transplant, you can't go out in the market and offer a hospital $10 million to give you a heart transplant, to jump the queue. Heart transplants are allocated on the basis of a waiting list that's organized on the basis of urgency, of need, how dire is the situation, and likelihood of success. So if you have more complicated health issues that might make the transplant less successful, you're less likely to get one. And it doesn't matter whether you're a billionaire industrialist or a factory worker, you're on the list according to your these medical and ethically determined rankings. You can't just auction off hearts. And most people think that's the best way to do it, that you don't want to have a market decide how hearts and kidneys and other life-saving transplants should be allocated. That just again reflects the deep ethical issues involved in this particular service. That's the second issue in the distribution. The third one is, I think, ends up being way more important than most people might think without... I mean, it's obviously important once you think about it, but most people probably don't think about it quite this way. It's extremely costly and sometimes basically impossible for most people to acquire the necessary information to make informed decisions about consumers. Information about the quality of providers and information about alternative treatments. Now, you can educate yourself. An educated patient is better than an uneducated patient. With the web today, it's easier to go to some reliable health-oriented websites and get good information about alternative treatments. But let's face it, most people don't have the background training to do a really careful evaluation of all the alternatives. And even more, it's really hard to decide whether Dr. A or Dr. B, Hospital A or Hospital B, will give you better care. It's very hard to get good information about that. There are rating services of various sorts, but the rating services are very clumsy and very hard for most people to figure out sensibly. The result is that people rely on experts to give them information. They don't have the information themselves, and especially people rely on their doctors. It's therefore a fundamental aspect of this kind of service that there be a high level of trust between patients and doctors. When patients learn that doctors get kickbacks for choosing one treatment over another, that they have a financial incentive to give certain treatments and not others, that's very unsettling, even if it turns out to be the best treatment. Right? It's even if the treatment the doctor uses is the best treatment, if a patient knows that the doctor has a big financial incentive to use one treatment over another, that makes people worried, raises anxiety, because you don't want that consideration to come into play in your doctor's decision about what treatment to use. You really want your doctors to be your advocate, to take your point of view, to have only your health interests in mind when they decide what the treatment should be. That's what it means to trust your doctor. And that trust is needed because of the information problem that most patients, most of the time, simply can't make a sophisticated judgment about which treatment would be optimal. Fourth special issue concerns the problem of preventative medicine. That is the distinction between a market for health and a market for treatment. What consumers want is to be healthy. They don't want to consume medical treatments. So you have a market for treatments, but what consumers actually want is health. From the point of view of the consumer, prevention is much more important than treatment. It's much more important to prevent illness than to be treated for getting illness. That's why vaccinations are such a fantastic human device. Vaccinations prevent the treatment of illness because it makes it unnecessary. The problem, and this is what makes this a difficult issue with respect to how healthcare system is organized, from the point of view of the producers of services, treatment is much more lucrative than prevention. Pharmaceutical companies make a hell of a lot more money out of treating illnesses than out of preventing illnesses. Indeed, imagine, and this is a fantasy, but imagine if a drug company, or even better, imagine if a scientist at a university who was altruistic and refused to patent this discovery, discovered a pill that if you took would make all other drugs unnecessary because you just wouldn't get sick. You know, this is a health pill, universal health pill. A universal health pill would devastate the market for pharmaceuticals, would destroy it. Right? The market for pharmaceuticals depends upon people getting sick rather than preventing illness. Now, I've exaggerated it, of course. You know, I mean, I shouldn't say, of course I exaggerate things. It's just that this was an exaggerated statement. There is money to be made out of prevention. The growth of fitness centers is an example of money being made out of preventative medicine. Gyms are a form of preventative medicine. It's a way of keeping people healthy rather than treating them for being ill. And there are drugs on the market. Vaccinations, after all, are produced by drug companies. The flu vaccine every year is a source of revenues for some pharmaceutical companies. So some money is made out of prevention. Nevertheless, I think the basic point is true. You know the folk saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, the pound of cure is where the money is to be made, not the ounce of prevention. Now, here is a very peculiar feature of the healthcare market and health treatment and care as having peculiar properties. That means you have to think carefully about how you want to organize it. Mostly in markets, the idea is that demand for a product generates the supply. Remember consumer sovereignty, we talked about it. It's what people want gives signals to producers to produce those things. So demands, what people want, determines what's supplied. Demand determines supply. There's a tendency in healthcare for the existence of a facility to generate the demand for its use. So if you're a hospital and you make the investment in having a CAT scan, a really expensive kind of imaging device, then you need to order treatments of patients in order to pay for the investment. Right, so since the demand for the use of a particular technology comes from the doctors, not the patients. The patients don't demand a CAT scan. The doctors employed in the hospital are the ones who have the orders for treatment. And since CAT scans are expensive, there's strong pressure in order to recoup the investment to order the treatments. There's a tendency for unnecessary treatments to occur because of the incentives to using them. And this can be intensified by other factors. In the American discussions about healthcare, it's often argued that malpractice suits, you know, suing doctors for mistakes in courts, leads them to engage in what's called defensive medicine. That is, ordering more tests than are needed so that if something goes wrong or if a patient is not cured, they can, in court, say, we did everything possible. They did all the possible tests, all the possible treatments, even if most of these tests they know have extremely low probability of revealing anything. That's what's referred to as defensive medicine. And it's thought to be a response to the threat of lawsuits. In the United States, there are more lawsuits around malpractice than in any other country, partially because lawsuits are one of the ways people can provide for their future health care. In the absence of a universal system that guarantees health care, if something goes wrong in a hospital and you're permanently disabled as a result, the one way you can get resources to compensate for that is by a court suit, because the system doesn't provide resources for people who suffer from the mistakes that happen in hospitals. But in any case, defensive medicine is one source of overtreatment, but so is this intrinsic problem that the supply of treatments determines the demand rather than the other way around. Finally, one last complication is that competition between providers, when you have a lot of intense competition, this leads to overinvestment in medical facilities. Overinvestment. And therefore, competition increases costs rather than reduces costs. Take the CAT scan example. Again, CAT scans, NMR equipment, any of these very expensive imaging devices, they cost a huge amount. If you have competition between hospitals and one hospital has a CAT scan, then every hospital in that competitive health market needs to get a CAT scan as well in order to compete. Every hospital wants these facilities in their competition for patients. They don't want to be in the position where one hospital says, join our insurance plan, our HMO, come to our hospital because we have all the best imaging devices, and the other hospital says, come to ours unless you need X, Y, or Z, right? So every hospital invests, when in fact, a much more efficient use of these technologies would be to have a hub system where specialized facilities would provide CAT scans for all the hospitals rather than each hospital having to have its own CAT scan. If you had specialized facilities that gave CAT scans for all hospitals, it would also mean that the hospitals, each individual hospital, would have to think twice about ordering CAT scans. They'd have to prioritize who really needs it, who doesn't. So it would also undermine this supply determines demand problem. Because doctors would say, okay, CAT scan for this condition is one of the things we might want to do, but in this particular patient, it's not likely to give us much information. In this patient, much more. Because there'd be a waiting list if there's a hub system rather than every hospital having a CAT scan, that actually improves the efficiency of the use of the resource. Competition in healthcare does not reduce costs. It leads to overinvestment and therefore increases costs. Those are very peculiar characteristics of this system. It's not true for hotels. Competition among hotels reduces room rates. It's not true for restaurants. Competition among restaurants reduces restaurant prices or improves the quality of the food. I mean, there's two kinds of competition going on. Same for cars, the same for bicycles. Healthcare, it's much more complicated. Competition does not necessarily reduce prices. Well, let's look at the American system. How given these special properties, how is healthcare organized in the United States? The first basic fact about the American system is that it is incredibly complicated. And I would say it's both complicated and incoherent. It's complicated and all the bits and pieces don't fit together. It's developed in a patchwork over the last half century or so. The modern American healthcare system really emerged after the Second World War. So it really began to consolidate its special features in the last 50 or 60 years. Here are some of the elements. All of the things I'm saying here, again, are in the textbook, in the book. So you don't have to write these all down. You can see it there. But here are examples of the different components. First of all, we have private fee-for-service provision. You can make an appointment with a doctor, have an appointment, get a treatment, and simply pay for the services you've received. That's called fee-for-service, when you simply go to a doctor and get treated in the same way that you go to a barber and get a haircut. We have government-run hospitals and services. The Veterans Administration hospitals are directly run by the government. The doctors are employees of the government on a salary. It's not fee-for-service. You go to the doctor, you get treated, but there is no direct fee charged for that service that you receive. It's paid for directly as a government hospital. That's true for military hospitals as well. These are two systems, the Veterans Administration and military hospitals for active duty servicemen and women. That's a separate system. But these are all direct government-run hospitals. We have government insurance, Medicare and Medicaid, and assuming that it survives the Affordable Care Act medical insurance system, will expand at least the Medicaid portion of that direct government insurance and reorganize the private insurance market. We have private insurance through employers. That's the way most families get their health insurance who are not retired. They get it through their employer. That's how I get my health insurance. I get it as part of my job at the University of Wisconsin. And we have individual private insurance. That is, you can simply, as a separate individual, go out and buy health insurance. I should note that the individual health insurance market, if you just want to go out and buy health insurance, not through an employer and not through a government program, you just want to go out and buy it, it's a pretty tough market to figure out. And the coverage that you can get, it's not simply that it's expensive, it's that it's very uneven. And that private insurance companies, when offering policies to just individual persons, often simply refuse to give them insurance if they feel that the person is at high risk of getting sick. If you have any prior conditions, the insurance company can simply refuse to insure you. I've also discovered I have a daughter who's in theater and therefore not working for an employer. She does individual freelancing in theater as a director. So we buy her health insurance. We could not find a health insurance policy at any price that would cover pregnancy. And that's because the insurance companies regard pregnancy as a choice. You know, you're choosing to need healthcare services by virtue of choosing to get pregnant. So pregnancy is not available, as in you cannot get insured for it. So if you get pregnant, all of the expenses have to be paid out of pocket, fee-for-service, which can be very expensive. That's perfectly reasonable from the point of view of a private insurance market. After all, the insurance company is simply an ordinary firm trying to maximize its profits by selling a product. And why would they sell a product when they know the expenses are going to be more than the income they're going to get from it? The premiums to cover pregnancy would have to be astronomically high, you know, $20,000, $30,000 a year, because of the complications that are quite possible within pregnancies. And since it's a voluntary choice in their view, their profit-maximizing strategy is simply to make that unavailable. Okay, that's the first feature of the American system. It's extremely complex. And all of these pieces just don't fit together very well. Second attribute. We have the most expensive system in the world, and it's an expensive system that's in which costs are rising rapidly. This is a chart from the book just to illustrate this. And you can see that the slope for the American curve is rising much more rapidly than it is in any other country. Now, the sheer fact that health spending per capita is going up, that fact I don't think should be a matter of any particular concern. The per capita spending on entertainment goes up as a country gets richer. The per capita spending on cars goes up as a country gets richer. And of all the things you can spend money on if you're a rich country, healthcare would seem to be a pretty good thing to spend money on. Health is something that we really value. It's also the case that in all of these, the developed countries, indeed everywhere in the world, populations are aging, and aging populations need more health care. So it's not, I think, in and of itself something of great concern that health care costs per capita go up over time. Why not? That seems like a reasonable way to spend our resources. The problem is when it's going up much more rapidly than elsewhere, and especially if when it's going up, you're not getting improved quality of health out of the increased expenses. A third attribute. We have lower access to health care than any other country, and we're the only rich country in the world without universal health care. And this will be true even after the current reform is fully in place. Many of the provisions of the current reform don't kick in until 2014, but even when they do kick in 2014, there will not be universal coverage of all people. This is another slide, again, from the book. It illustrates the proportion of people with no insurance, that's the bottom bar, in the United States. I think I didn't put the date on the slide. I believe this is probably data from around 2005 or so, maybe a little later. It shows the proportion of people without any kind of insurance at all as a function of what their income is. And 30% of people below the poverty line have no insurance at all. Let me just make a comment about this issue of access and the problem of private insurance and its relationship to providing insurance. This is what can be called the dilemma of private insurance exclusions, which bears on the problem in the current healthcare reform that goes under the name of mandates. That's one of the properties of the current healthcare reform that has been the most controversial, that is requiring that all people buy health insurance. So here's the basic structure of this problem. Insurance companies make money by selling insurance to people who are healthy, right? That's where you make your money. The ideal person from the point of view of auto insurance is somebody who never has an accident. The ideal person from somebody who buys fire insurance is somebody who has sprinklers and takes good care that their house never catches on fire. And the ideal person to provide health insurance to is somebody who pays premiums every year and never gets sick. They increase their profits by refusing to insure people with existing health problems and refusing to renew insurance once a person gets sick. That is, if you have a health insurance policy and you get sick and then you have to renew your policy, you might get dropped by the insurance company. It will say, we don't want to insure you anymore. So they did cover your health care costs when you first got sick. Let's say you got cancer, the early treatments, but they won't cover your health care costs afterwards because they dropped the policy. To guarantee universal access to insurance, these practices have to be prevented. You have to prevent insurance companies from behaving this way. Insurance companies have to be prevented from refusing insurance because of existing conditions. So if you want everybody to have insurance, you have to prevent insurance companies from refusing to insure people because of prior conditions. But this is only possible if healthy people are required to buy health insurance. Otherwise, they will wait to get sick and then buy insurance. So just imagine the following world. We have private insurance companies. We pass a law that says you cannot deny people health insurance because of prior conditions. So everybody can buy health insurance. And we also say you can't charge different premiums for people with prior conditions. That is, it would be, in effect, denial of health insurance if the insurance company was free to charge whatever they wanted. Yes, we'll insure you. You have cancer, but we'll insure you, but your premiums will be $100,000 a year. Well, that's not insurance. That's just requiring that people pay for their own health care. So imagine that we pass this law, which most people think would be good. You cannot deny health insurance to people. And you have to charge the same premium for everybody. You can't jack up the premiums just because somebody has a condition. But we don't require that people buy health insurance. So what do people do under those conditions? What they do is they don't buy health insurance until they get sick. They wait until they get sick, and then they buy the health insurance. And the health insurance company has to sell them the insurance at the same premium they charge everybody. If we had such a system, if that's the way we did it, the premiums would have to be high for everyone. That is, the only way the insurance companies could make money would be to charge very high premiums for everybody if people could wait until they got sick in order to get health insurance. Just think about it the same way with automobile insurance. What if you only bought your auto insurance after you had a car accident? Well, you can see the only way insurance companies could afford to provide insurance after the fact would be if the premiums were super high, because they would have to cover the cost of all these accidents that occur, but the people who had those accidents hadn't been paying premiums beforehand. That's what the individual mandate is supposed to does accomplish. It says, if we want everybody to be able to buy insurance and we want to block insurance companies from denying insurance to people, then we have to require everybody to buy insurance. You can't make it optional. It has to be required. And this is what's called a mandate. I sent around to you a interesting essay written by a conservative health economist. This is not by a liberal in the American health industry. This is a conservative health economist who is defending the Obama healthcare reforms, and in particular this issue of the individual mandate, but defending it on the grounds that this is a very conservative position. It's not a liberal position. It's the position that the Republican Party supported until Obama passed this, proposed this law. Until that point, this was the Republican position, was Romney's position. What the economist basically says is, if you don't have a mandate, then you don't actually, what you do is you allow people to be freeloaders on everybody else's buying insurance. You basically encourage irresponsibility. And if there's one word that is closely associated with at least some varieties of conservative political philosophy. It's that people should take individual responsibility for their lives. Well, the question is, do your policies require people to act responsibly or not? And what the mandate does is require people to be responsible by blocking their ability to be free riders. They can't be free riders on other people's purchase of insurance. And that's in fact why when Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he defended the mandate for Massachusetts. That was the principle. Liberals in general have preferred government insurance, universal insurance simply provided for everybody, like Medicare, which is a different system. You're not buying it on the market, it's provided by the government. That's been the liberal solution, is government-provided health care. The conservative solution has been private insurance company-provided health care. And then if you want to make it universal, you have to have a mandate. And that's what that op-ed, that essay that I sent you, discusses, which I would encourage you to read because it's, I thought, a very thoughtful essay that helps to understand the nature of the debate over the current health care reforms, which is not so much a debate about the actual provisions and more a debate about who passed the reform. Okay. Back to the attributes of the American system. The fourth element of the system is a relatively minimal concern with prevention. Not no concern. Historically, the United States has had actually a pretty active public health service. And in certain times, we have been a leader in providing for certain kinds of preventative medicine, preventative health care. In the early part of the 20th century, in the city of Milwaukee, in fact, Milwaukee was at the forefront of what was called the progressive movement of the era. That was a kind of good government that was concerned with things like good sewer systems and good water supplies for cities. Good sewer systems and good water supplies are a form of preventative medicine. They prevent illness. And the U.S. At various times has been a leader in that. More recently, however, I think, we've been much more preoccupied with the medical treatment of disease than with public health and preventative medicine. We, as I mentioned, are one of, I should say to be sure, one of the only, I believe we are the only, developed country which does not provide universal free vaccinations to children. And when, at various times, efforts to expand subsidies for vaccinations to children have been proposed, it's been very controversial. We do not provide universal free prenatal care for pregnant women, even though the research is unequivocal that $1 of prenatal care saves, on average, $3 of medical expenses of postnatal care. The market logic of the provision of health care doesn't encourage prenatal care, since prenatal care would have to be paid by taxpayers to be effective. In order to have an effective prenatal care system, it just simply needs to be made free to people so that they don't face an immediate charge in which they have to, as individuals, think about the trade-off between present expenses and possible future expenses. If you have to pay something yourself, many people will only go to doctors when something hurts. Another example of weakness of preventative health care is the relative weakness of our occupational safety and health regulations and their enforcement. And that's really how you should think about things like safety regulations in workplaces, regulations about toxic fumes, about the conditions under which workers work in different industries. Those should be thought of as preventative medicine. They're public health issues. The United States does have occupational safety and health laws. On the books, The occupational safety and health laws in the United States are strong and good. The problem is the enforcement has declined significantly. We only have enough inspectors in the Occupational Safety and Health Administration at the present to visit each workplace once every 50 years. So if you don't have inspectors, then violations increase. Well, ultimately, all of this stuff only matters if it actually is reflected in health outcomes. And here is where I think the consequences of our patchwork, incoherent, chaotic system become the most telling. It seems just paradoxical and ironic that we can spend more per capita than any other place in the world and generally have worse health outcomes. Here's just a few examples. Infant deaths per 1,000 live births. We rank 35th in the world. I didn't put on the slide the date in the book, the date for these data are presented. I think this is sometime in the last decade. We rank 35th in the world. Life expectancy at birth for both sexes. United States ranks 34th. Canada, which is a very similar country, roughly the same standard of living as the United States, our principal trading partner. Any Canadians in the class? Sometimes there's a Canadian that strays down to Wisconsin to go to school. The United States ranks 34th in life expectancy at birth. These health outcomes vary across race and other categories. We'll discuss some of this when we look at the issues of racial inequality. Here is a chart that shows the change in the ratio of African American infant mortality to white infant mortality between 1964 and 1998. And the thing which is most troubling about this is not merely that the rate is higher among African Americans than among whites, but that it's gotten progressively worse over time. During the period when the war on poverty was reducing inequality in living conditions between blacks and whites, during that period in the late 60s and early 70s, the ratio of infant mortality was declining. Since those policies were eroded and then ended, the ratios have gotten worse. Finally, this is a little chart just to illustrate the basic point that there is a relationship between life expectancy at birth and the amount of income you pay, you spend per capita. This data is from 1990. I couldn't find a similar chart that would just lay this out more recently, but I think the basic pattern is the same. So if you do spend more, you get better health outcomes, higher life expectancy, but the United States is the outlier where we spend a huge amount more and don't get higher life expectancy. What that suggests is that there's something wrong in the way the healthcare system is organized, that it does not play itself out with desirable health outcomes. Now, this is not to say that there are no defenses of the kind of healthcare system we have. We have a private, market-based health insurance system. And even with the Obama reforms, it will still be a private health insurance-based system. It's just that the government is going to change the rules under which citizens get connected to health insurance in the private market. People still buy health insurance in the market. Employers still will provide most health insurance for most people. They will buy their health insurance in the market. This will not be a government-run health system. It'll be a private market health insurance system, but with new rules that will make universal access more likely. There are two kinds of arguments that are generally made in favor of this. The first is this very simple argument that we've been looking at in different contexts, the simple idea that competition spurs cost saving and innovation. That's what markets are good at. They form competition. You can't take anything for granted. You have to always be on your toes. And because of competitive pressures, this will lead to reductions of costs and to innovation. That's the standard argument. As I've already pointed out, competition just doesn't work that way in healthcare markets. There may be special circumstances in which competition will reduce certain kinds of costs, but more generally, in healthcare, because people value the service so much, because doctors are the key providers of information, and because competition leads to overinvestment, because of all of these things working together, intensified competition tends to raise costs rather than lower them. But there's a second issue which markets are involved in, for which there's perhaps more argument, and at least it's one that has to be thought about, and it's called the moral hazard problem. And free markets are thought to be a way to solve the moral hazard problem. Let me explain what a moral hazard problem is. We will encounter moral hazards in other contexts as well. We'll see that this is a problem in financial markets. When we eventually get to that discussion, the problem of banks in a highly developed financial system also has these moral hazard problems. Here's what a moral hazard problem is. It's a situation in which there is no incentive to worry about the costs and someone else is paying the bill. Insurance sometimes creates a moral hazard by enabling people to engage in riskier behavior than they would otherwise. Right? So it's a pretty straightforward argument. If you have car insurance, you're likely to drive faster and more recklessly than if you don't. If you have health insurance, you're likely to take care of your body less than you would otherwise do because your insurance will cover the costs of your behavior. If you have insurance, you will tend to overuse medical services since you do not have to pay each time you go to the doctor. And this has the effect of imposing costs on other people. The solution proposed by defenders of the market is to rely on the market and competition to force down prices and enforce personal responsibility through co-payments and other charges. So the solution to the moral hazard problem that's proposed by defenders of the market is that the market will impose this discipline on people, make them responsible by making them bear the costs of their own choices. What are the problems with this argument? First of all, it's a tremendously exaggerated problem in the particular case of medical care. The problem in the medical system is people not going to the doctor until they're very sick, rather than going to the doctor.
Even people that have good health insurance do not overuse the health system. They wait too long. One of the problems in health systems is that people wait too long to go to the doctor. They discount the early warning signs of severe illness. They don't go for the checkups or the screenings for various kinds of health problems, and only find out that they have a health after they have some serious health event. Now, it is true that there are people who overuse the medical system. But there are greater costs to the healthcare system because people don't use it enough. That might seem kind of weird, right? How can the system's costs go up if people underuse the system? Well, furthermore, the moral hazard problem, to the extent that there's a problem, is almost impossible to eliminate as long as insurance plays an important role. out to be one of these problems, and we'll all have a problem in healthcare, that probably we just have to live with, because the cure to that problem is worse than the problem itself. Attempts to deal with the moral hazard issues of healthcare have just repeatedly failed. More auditors, more paperwork, more deductibles. The problem with all of these devices to make people more accountable for their own healthcare costs, to make, for example, co-payment. The co-payment system is you go to the doctor, your insurance pays a part of it, and you pay for it. That's co-payment. The problem with all of these things is that it adds to the administrative costs and paperwork costs of running the healthcare system. The administrative costs of running the American healthcare system is vastly higher than in systems that don't require individual persons to have individual insurance. Let me just jump ahead. Here's a comparison of the administrative overhead costs as a percent of total costs in 2003 in various systems for providing health care. In private insurance, somewhere between 10 and 12% of all the costs of private insurance are simply paperwork costs. And that's compared to only about 1% in Canada, which has a single payer government administered system. It also is compared to only about 2% in the veterans administration, which is another public provider system. So this is basically the point. The moral hazard problem is a problem, but to solve the problem, you have to have all sorts of complexity. Auditors, health insurance commissions that are going to deny people service and make them pay it themselves, co-payments, all of these complexities then add to the administrative cost of it. And so which is better, to have a little bit of moral hazard problem without all these administrative costs, or a little bit less of a moral hazard problem with huge administrative costs? For-profit hospitals are not more efficient than non-profit hospitals. They're just more selective in who they treat. One way of dealing with these kinds of issues is to have a hospital that simply excludes uninsured poor people, and that makes it look like you're more profitable. It's not the case that non-profit hospitals are less efficient than for-profit hospitals. The market logic of having the hospital run on profit-making maximizing principles doesn't make them more efficient. What it does is makes them more selective in who they treat. They can treat those patients who are able to truly cover the costs of their services. And as I said, in terms of the problem with the market logic, increasing competition doesn't lead to decreasing costs, which leads to over-investment. Let me are discussed in detail in the chapter. I don't think through them, which I want to be able to read the details there. So first, the Veterans Administration. Veterans Administration is a system of direct health care provided to U.S. military veterans that was established after World War II. These are hospitals run by the government. So they are really government. Direct provision. They're not market rates. It's not fee for service. It's not paid for by private insurance. 25 years ago or so, the Veterans Administration was a mess. The hospitals were deteriorating, the morale was low, efficiency was terrible, the quality was very uneven. And given the general turn towards privatization in the United States in the last one might have thought that given the failures of the Veterans Administration, of the hospitals in the Veterans Administration, one might have thought that the solution that would have been given would have included together, to privatize it, and to have veterans into the regular health insurance market, perhaps with vouchers. One would have thought that the solution, given the overall political configuration in the United States, would have been to replace the Veterans Administration with something that would be more or less like Medicare. You know, so you could have extended Medicare to veterans, or to affect Medicare, just like the elderly, rather than a specialized hospital system just for themselves. The elderly select their health care on the open market and pay for it through the Medicare public insurance system. They don't have Medicare, there are no Medicare hospitals. But instead, what happened 25 years ago or so was a major internal reorganization of the Veterans Administration hospital system. With new technologies, new procedures, quality control, new systems of cost control. And the result was a dramatic improvement on every indicator on the quality of service provided. It doesn't mean that there aren't problems, it just means that compared to other hospitals in the United States, compared on average to both for-profit hospitals and the broader non-profit market-based hospitals, are the Veterans Administration hospitals doing exceptionally well. In 2003, the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, compared the veterans' health facilities on 11 measures of quality with fee-for-service Medicare. And on all 11 measures, the quality of care of the veterans' facilities is significantly better. There's also an organization called the National Committee for Quality Assurance, which is an organization that provides information on health care quality for businesses to help businesses pick providers. And it ranks healthcare plans on 17 different kinds of performance measures. In every single category, the Veterans Administration Hospitals, this was in 2005, the Veterans Administration Hospitals outperformed the highest rated non-veterans administration. The Veterans Administration system as a whole outperformed the Mayo Clinic. And it's not because they're selective and only treat relatively healthy patients. No, they treat all veterans. One of the key things about the Veterans Administration that makes it possible to deliver this quality is that they track the same patients over their entire life after they retire from the military. So they have integrated healthcare records and have a big incentive for preventing healthcare, since they are going to be dealing with the same patients under the same budget constraints in a unified system over time. And as we saw in the previous slide here, the Veterans Administration overhead costs are dramatically less than private health insurance in the United States. Okay, just a minute on the the details of the Canadian system are provided in the chapter. The key idea of the Canadian system is what's called single-payer health insurance. There's lots of variations and nuances, but the basic idea is that the government provides all the payments to doctors and hospitals. They're a single payer. But the government does not itself provide the health care itself. So there's a single unified insurance system in which the government pays for these services. And the fees that are done are negotiated on an annual basis between the government insurance system and the Association of Doctors and Hospitals. Sometimes they're negotiating programs for how much we pay for each service. It's a single payer system. It's universal for all systems. Citizens, it's comprehensive, and so on. The details are in the chapter. The irony is that in Canada, where there is a universal provision of the system for everyone, there's actually greater freedom of choice for patients than there is in the U.S. In Canada, You're not restricted to go to particular doctors who are in the system and not in the system. You go to any doctor. When you get an insurance policy through your employer in the United States, it usually restricts you to go to particular doctors. In Canada, you as an individual doctor can set up an individual office. You can be a solo practitioner. It's very tough to be a solo practitioner in the United States because of the complexities in the insurance system. There's greater freedom for both doctors and patients precisely because there's a unified insurance system, even though it is paid for by the government. Well, in the chapter, there's data that's going to present the comparison. I encourage you to look at it and read it carefully, and I'll see you on Tuesday.